Chapter 2. Like many suburban saplings raised in 1960s America, I would bring lunch to school every day. It was a rare occasion that I would buy a lunch the cafeteria provided. This was for two reasons. One, it was cost prohibitive for my parents to do so, and two, the food the cafeteria served was dreadful. Anyone growing up at this time anywhere in America knows what I mean, and therefore I need not elaborate. I will confess, however, to a penchant for the excessively glutinous white rice served by way of an old-fashioned ice cream scooper and deposited as a near-perfect sphere in a tiny pastel melamine bowl. Now, there were those students who bought lunch either regularly or on occasion. I, however, was only given money, 5 to 10 cents, solely for the purchase of a half pint of milk. My lactose intolerance was, as yet, undiscovered. Though many of my friends brought their lunches, the contents of my lunchbox differed significantly from those of my peers. A prime example of my portable childhood lunch, lovingly packed into a pop image-themed metal container, a.k.a. a Partridge Family or Batman lunchbox, would be something akin to the following. A scrambled egg, fried potato, and sautéed sweet green pepper sandwich on two slices of Italian bread or in a wedge or hero, which is a long loaf of Italian bread sliced horizontally and filled with whatever you choose to fill it with. In Philadelphia, they are called hoagies. One piece of fruit, apple, pear, or orange. One highly processed, prepackaged, store-bought dessert, Twinkie, Double Dog, Ring Ding, or Ho-Ho, the names of which, in retrospect, seem as inappropriate as their ingredients. The fruit and dessert were standard fare, but it was the sandwiches that were the marvel and oftentimes made me the envy of my friends. My dear friend Ricky S. and I would trade sandwiches every now and again. The reason for this was that he was given a marshmallow fluff sandwich on white bread every day of grade school. Today, this would be considered a form of child abuse. However, in those days, no one cared, least of all me, who was more than happy to relinquish my gourmet fare for the unhealthiest schmear between two slices of bread known to man. I'm sure he was equally happy to ingest something from which he could derive midday nourishment for once in his very white life. It is important to note that, for the most part, my exotic and coveted lunches were directly related to the previous night's dinner. A typical week of said lunches might have looked something like this. Monday, meatball wedge. As we had meatballs in a slow-cooked homemade ragu with pasta for Sunday dinner, this lunch was a natural choice. Tuesday, chicken cutlets on Italian bread or a wedge with the smallest amount of butter or mayo and lettuce. Wednesday, eggplant parmigiana wedge. The eggplant parmigiana was not breaded. It was made in a light tomato sauce, had very little cheese, and incorporated thinly sliced potatoes. Thursday, veal cutlet sandwich or wedge with a small amount of butter and lettuce. This was in the days of affordable veal. Friday, scrambled egg, pepper, and potato wedge. As the food budget was wearing thin by the end of the week, this was an inexpensive lunch my mother might whip up on a Thursday night after a simple dinner of pasta and salad. Lunches on the weekends were catch-as-catch-can. Whether friends were at my house or vice versa, we would raid the fridge and make stacks of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. As we got older, we would make sandwiches of every ilk. Tuna salad, bologna and mustard, ham and cheese, liverwurst and red onion, turkey breast and mayo, American cheese and mayo, all on whatever bread was available. Sliced white, Italian, bagels, Kaiser rolls, etc. We ravaged jars of dill pickles and sweet gherkins, bags of Ruffles, potato chips, and Fritos. We washed it all down with gallons of milk, orange juice, apple juice, or lemonade. Did any of us ever drink water? For dessert, we emptied the freezers of ice pops of every unnatural color and flavoring. During school breaks, we did the same, but in winter, we added hot chocolate, Swiss Miss with little marshmallows from individual packets, to our gluttonous midday rampages. During summer vacations, we followed the same routine like crazed ants at an endless picnic. I don't remember anyone in our neighborhood ever going on an extended summer vacation, so we all just hung around together for those two humid months, going from one dwelling to another, eating our own and each other's parents out of house and home. I found summer vacations so joyful. The days were long, allowing us to play outside until 9 p.m., at which point we would have already negotiated a sleepover at one or another of our homes so that we might never be parted even in slumber. Summertime also brought my favorite holiday besides Christmas, Independence Day, also known as the 4th of July. When I was a boy, 4th of July celebrations were very important in our family. At this time, all or most of my family members who had been part of the great wave of Italian immigrants were still alive. Compared to the abject poverty of the Italian South, America held for them everything Italy could not offer or would not allow. It was in America that their dreams of a new and successful life came true. They created Italian enclaves all over the country by sending for family and friends once work had been secured. America gave them the best of both worlds, a country where prospects were many and the opportunity to surround themselves with extended family. In this new world, they would birth new generations who had options available to them never thought possible in the poor and corrupt towns of southern Italy. In America, they worked together, grew together, and sometimes grew apart together. Food was the connective tissue that brought them again and again into each other's homes, backyards, front porches, campsites, beaches, and hearts. The lubricant that is wine ameliorated any squeaky emotional wheels, just as at times it was fuel for any dark and dormant emotional fires. I remember many of these Independence Day celebrations being held at our house in northern Westchester. We would spend days preparing for the onslaught of relatives from both sides. Out of paper, string, and poster board, my father would make all of the decorations, from hand-painted pennants to red, white, and blue stovepipe hats. With the welding equipment he used to make steel sculpture, he would cut 50-gallon drums in half lengthwise and place them on sawhorses. They were then filled with charcoal, and old steel fridge freezer shelves were placed across the top, thus creating two enormous barbecues. Over these makeshift grills, the ubiquitous hamburgers and hot dogs were cooked alongside Italian sausages, a simple culinary representation of the melding of two distinctive cultures. The sausages were served on long wedges with slowly sautéed onions and red and green peppers. Jug wine was served, as well as glasses of beer straight from a frigid keg. In those days, the ice came in blocks, not in bags of cubes. And as a young boy, I relished the task of breaking it into smaller chunks with a deadly ice pick so that they would fit around the portly beer keg that sat in a basin wrapped in thick canvas, waiting to be tapped. For dessert, besides peaches soaked in wine, my mother always made a homemade rectangular sponge cake decorated with the stars and stripes. The surface was covered in white icing, with fresh strawberries comprising the red stripes, and blueberries making up the blue field behind the stars. Music followed dinner as surely as games of horseshoes and bocce preceded it. Uncles on mandolin or piano sang old Italian folk songs or Italian versions of bygone American ditties like Darktown Strutter's Ball. These, along with a few American classics like Yankee Doodle and Your Grand Old Flag, created the perfect accompaniment to three generations bound by Italian traditions who'd come together to celebrate the quintessential American holiday. As more and more of the first-generation immigrants passed away, the 4th of July seemed to become less and less important. We still celebrated it, but certainly not in the numbers or with the same passion we once had. As my generation reached early adulthood, we began to form our own political opinions, which were usually not in keeping with those of many of the older generations, who were rather conservative and still believed that America was the greatest country in the world, no matter what. After the horror of the 9/11 attacks, these political differences were exacerbated. For me, and some of the more liberal family members, patriotism seemed to have been monopolized by those with hawkish views of how to right that terrible wrong, and who waved the American flag more like a weapon than a symbol of freedom, acceptance, and possibility. We were becoming once again a country where immigrants were vilified, and disagreeing with the government's wars in the Middle East was practically tantamount to treason. Ultra-conservatives even started calling French fries freedom fries, as well as boycotting and even smashing bottles of French wine because the French refused to send troops to fight alongside the United States in Iraq. I wish they had just sent them to me. Not the troops, the wine. I am hoping now, as I write this, that those days will soon be behind us. Now that I spend most of my time in London, I must admit, celebrating American Independence Day is a tad uncomfortable, for one fairly obvious reason. The colonists won and the British lost. I know the war was a long time ago, but I never quite know how to celebrate that victorious day here without feeling like I'm rubbing it in some Brit's face, like my in-laws. However, during the Obama administration, my family and I were fortunate enough to be invited to two July 4th fetes at Winfield House in Regent's Park, the home of the American ambassador. These were lovely, casually posh daytime affairs for expats, a nice word for immigrants, and their families, complete with American military bands, jazz singers, and all the traditional American foods one could eat. How ironic that in England, of all places, on these two occasions, I would be reminded of all the positive aspects of this important American day. Taking part in joyous celebrations of American democracy on foreign soil made me long for a time in my youth when the sausage and peppers of Italian immigrants sat peacefully on the grill alongside their American cousins, the hot dog and the hamburger. My maternal grandmother, Concetta, was one of the funniest and most generous people I've ever met. She was also an extraordinary cook. Her parents emigrated from Calabria when she was 3 years of age to Verplank, New York, a small town about 40 miles north of Manhattan. She was taught to cook by her mother and, as far as I'm concerned, perfected every recipe. Like my mother, she was someone who could well have been a very successful professional chef had she so chosen or had she been given the choice. It was very rare not to see her in the kitchen preparing some dish or another. If she was not in her kitchen, she was in the basement, which was home to an auxiliary kitchen where she often did prep work. It was down there, on an old yellow and green enamel-top table, that she would make her light-as-a-feather, soft-as-a-baby's-bottom pizza dough. On the gas stove, perilously unventilated, she would prepare sauce or boil pasta for large gatherings that were held there if the main kitchen was unable to accommodate the ever-growing extended family. That basement, to me, was a wonderful kind of time capsule and sanctuary. Divided by a staircase that led to an upstairs hallway, it boasted the makeshift auxiliary kitchen on one side, complete with an old washing machine with hand-cranked rollers that was still very much in use, as well as my grandfather Vincenzo's workshop on the opposite side. Along one wall sat a long workbench with aging hand tools and dozens of glass jars filled with screws, nails, washers, nuts and bolts hanging from their lids, which were nailed to the underside of a wooden shelf. A most sculptural presentation of a handyman's bric-a-brac, if ever there was one. In the far left corner of this space was a door to the room that I loved most, the wine cellar. This was a low-ceilinged, cave-like room, approximately 8 feet by 10 feet, that one entered through a roughly made whitewashed door that was rotting from the bottom up due to the excessive dampness to which the floor and walls clung so dearly. Inside, to the right, were rough-hewn shelves on which rested the countless long-necked soda bottles that held the precious homemade tomato sauce of the last season. I will digress here to explain of what this vital red liquor was composed and how it was made. Tropiano bottled tomato sauce. Ingredients. Bushels of tomatoes. You decide how many. Salt. Fresh basil. Equipment. One outdoor open fireplace or fire pit with heavy metal grates. Fire. Two large galvanized aluminum tubs. One white pillowcase. Lots of old, long-necked glass soda bottles. One ladle. One funnel. Lots of new soda bottle caps. One bottle capping device. One thick piece of oilcloth big enough to cover one of the tubs. Enough water to fill one of the tubs. How to make the fire. Fill one tub with water and place it on the grate over the fire. Take a lot of the tomatoes, shove them into the pillowcase, and squeeze the shit out of them over the other tub so that the juice of the tomatoes oozes through the weave of the pillowcase, making it look like a relic of the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Continue until all the tomatoes are gone, or until you feel like Macbeth at the end of his play. One by one, fill the bottles with a ladle via funnel with the tomato juice and add a pinch of salt and a basil leaf to each. Cap the bottles. Put the bottles in the water that's in the other tub. Cover them with the oilcloth. boil them for a while. I can't remember what the health ruling is on this, but I take no responsibility for any foodborne illnesses. Take out the bottles. Let them cool. Put them in my grandfather's wine cellar, or store in a cool, dry place more convenient for you. This sauce was used throughout the year. It was light and sweet and could be cooked with olive oil, sautéed garlic and onions, or doctored up any which way one chose. One or two long days of work for months of red gold. The bottles would be stored in the wine cellar on wooden shelves alongside mason jars containing pickled green tomatoes or roasted peppers suspended in olive oil flavored with salt and a single clove of garlic. From the wooden beams over these vacuum-sealed treasures hung small homemade salami and waxy pear-shaped bulbs of provolone cheese. And now we must return to the wine cellar. Yes, we must return to the must. For the must was all-consuming when one entered the wine cellar. Must and mildew, dank and deep, coated everything, including the aged wine press that stood so proudly in the corner. One was sure that new life forms were breeding from the spores that danced on every surface, and consequently one's nostrils and lungs after the first inhale. But the pride that my grandfather took in drawing out his vinified love from the fetid oak barrel into the abraded decanter and presenting it to my father or my uncles, and in later years me and my cousins, made up for any respiratory diseases we were sure to contract. It was an honor to be asked to participate in, or even bear witness to, the ritual in the wine cellar. In fact, I remember being furious when my sisters wanted to tag along, as I saw this as a distinctly male rite of passage. At any rate, those of us lucky enough to be present swelled with pride as the cloudy purple liquor was carried upstairs to the table in its decanter, poured into juice glasses, toasted with, and drunk heartily. Was it the best wine in the world? No. Was it the worst? Very close. Did it matter? No. It was part of my grandfather, whom we adored, and that made it the sweetest liquid ever to pass our lips. The house that holds that cellar, that kitchen, and those memories was sold long ago. But the flavors and aromas, both tart and sweet, musty and fresh, inhabit my nose, my mouth, and my heart to this day. In the backyard of the Tropiano house was a sizable garden in which my grandparents not only grew every vegetable imaginable, but also raised rabbits, chickens, and the occasional goat or two, all used to sustain a growing family. This garden and their home were a hub of activities that changed with the seasons, but were all ultimately dedicated to what would end up on a plate, from the planting of vegetables and raising of animals to the grafting of branches from one fruit tree onto another, to the repairing of the outdoor fireplace in which the bottles of homemade tomato sauce were boiled in order to pasteurize them. My grandparents had left the extreme poverty of Calabria and, like their forebears, knew nothing but labor. All of that labor was dedicated to survival and creating a life with only the most minimal of creature comforts. Nothing went to waste, and luxuries were unheard of. Only what was necessary was, well, needed. In southern Italy, even into the early 20th century, a feudal system was still in place, and most people worked the land for wealthy property owners. America held the promise of jobs for both men and women outside of the home, yet for many of them, this did not mean that the agricultural and manual skills that were basically part of their DNA would no longer be used after they settled down in a new country. In fact, for a great many, the mindset never changed. If you could grow it, raise it, hunt it, cultivate it, build it, or repair it yourself, why buy it or pay someone else to do it? Therefore, backyards became microcosms of the land they had abandoned. If you've ever been to Italy, you'll have noticed gardens and grapevines growing just about anywhere and everywhere, terraced expertly up steep hills, down narrow valleys, on rocky outcroppings, or right next to the autostrada. The Italians have a gift for cultivating and growing some of the best produce in rather extreme geographical settings. For a mountainous country, the number of vineyards and small farms is extraordinary, as are the quality and variety of what they produce. In Sicily, people are willing to risk everything to live and cultivate some of the best vegetables and wine grapes in the volcanic soil near the still-active Mount Etna. In the region of Campania, just outside of Naples, The rich earth beneath a quivering Vesuvius imparts the incredibly deep, sweet flavor of the San Marzano tomato, again a result of millennia-old volcanic soil. So when my grandparents set up their home in America, they created not only a very large vegetable garden in the backyard, but, when my mother was young, a small farmlet with a couple of goats, chickens, rabbits, and any other animal of reasonable size that was in some way useful or edible. And every bit of those animals that was edible was eaten. When a chicken was roasted, the liver, heart, and feet were all prepared according to old family recipes, and the carcass used to make soup or stock. The same went for the rabbits, which I know is hard for a lot of people to hear. As kids, my sisters and I would visit the rabbits in their makeshift hutches that my grandfather had hammered together himself out of scrap lumber and bits of old screen doors. We would feed the rabbits and ask him their names. He'd find a way to avoid the question, as I guess he knew it's always best not to name the thing you're going to kill. But I do remember his intimating that the most plump of the brood was not long for this world. The goat, whose milk was drunk straight from the teat by the children, would inevitably be brought to the basement and strung up by its hind legs, its throat would be slit, its body drained of its blood, and finally, it would be quartered. I have it on good authority that when my parents were engaged, my father was present at one of these intimate eviscerations. However, on this occasion, his soon-to-be father-in-law unfortunately chose too dull a knife for the brutal task at hand. Upon witnessing the poor beast suffer so, causing it to urinate all over those present, my father promptly passed out. Seeing her future son-in-law prostrate on the floor, my grandmother turned to her daughter and asked, "You're going to marry him?" I know it may be disconcerting for many people to hear stories like this, but these events were very much a part of everyday life, although why somebody didn't sharpen the knife is beyond me. Even though there was a grocery store a couple miles away, where of course my grandmother shopped for this and that, old habits are hard to break, especially if there isn't any need to. The hunting, skinning, quartering, and ultimately eating of all sorts of animals were important traditions to be cherished. I was about 13 when I entered my grandmother's back porch one day to find her skinning a squirrel given to her by a friend who had gone hunting that day. I was agog. I looked at her as though she were mad, and she looked back at me, quizzically, as though I were the one who was mad. I remember many times opening up the freezer to find neat rows of blackbird corpses in plastic wrap, as well as eels or a variety of venison cuts, all gifts from friends who had recently fished or hunted. In return for these gifts, my grandmother would offer payment. Obviously, it would have been an insult to take money for what was considered a gift, but an offer to pay had to be made, and she always did so. After a short, mostly-for-show squabble about money that shouldn't have been offered and would never be taken, my grandmother would present the gift-giver, by way of thanks, with homemade cookies, pizza, a savory pie, or a bottle of my grandfather's wine, all of which were always on hand. I like these little acts of generosity, as I believe they make for deeper friendships, especially if the gifts are something one has made by hand or done something out of the ordinary to acquire. Speaking about these moments of giving someone you love a practical gift, my parents never visited their parents without bringing something. I still cannot bear the thought of arriving at someone's home empty-handed. However, in my family, this simple act was never as cut and dry as it should have been. Let's say that we visit my grandparents on a Sunday, and my mother has brought a chicken, some cheese she knows my grandmother likes, and maybe a Fanny Farmer chocolate sampler to satisfy her sweet tooth. Let's say that happens. Usually, the person receiving the gifts might react with something like, "Oh, thank you for the chicken," and blah, 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 but there was no need for you to do that. The other person might reply, "Oh, it's nothing. The chicken was fresh and on sale, and I know you like blah, blah, blah." The recipient would then probably say something like, "Well, that's very generous of you." And that would be the end of that. And in most families, that would be the end of that. But no. No. Not in my family. In fact, very much the opposite inevitably happened during a visit to my grandparents of a Sunday. So that you might best understand it, I have dramatized one of these events below. It's important to note that these people all love each other very much. The departure. We are in a kitchen in a small working-class home in Verplank, New York, circa 1972. Around a long table sit my sister Gina, 9, my sister Christine, 6, me, 12, my father, 43, and my maternal grandfather, 70s. At the sink are my mother, late 30s, and her mother, my grandmother, 60s. A large meal has just been completed. My grandmother starts to fill a plastic bag with fresh vegetables. My mother, what are you doing? My grandmother, I'm giving you some of the tomatoes. My mother, I don't want any. My grandmother, they're from the garden. My mother, I just got some from Grace's garden. My grandmother, how are they? My mother, nice. My grandmother, we'll take these too. My mother, I don't want them. My grandmother, why not? My mother, because I already... All right, just give me a few. My grandmother, they're beautiful, look. My mother, I see them. My grandmother adds more than a few tomatoes to the bag. My mother, what are you doing? My grandmother, I'm giving you the tomatoes. My mother, how many are you giving me? My grandmother, I don't know. My mother, stop, that's enough. My grandmother, just take the tomatoes. My mother sighs, a silence. The men finish their wine. My mother, kids, get your coats. We do. My mother, to my father. Are you okay to drive? My father, who, me? My mother, yes, you. My father, I'm fine. My mother, how much wine did you have? My father, not enough for you to worry about. My mother, have a coffee. My father, I had a coffee. My mother, then why are you having wine? My father, because your father poured it for me. My mother, that doesn't mean you have to drink it. My father, well, it would be impolite. He looks at my grandfather, who nods and smiles. My father finishes the wine and stands up. My grandmother hands him the now very full bag. My grandmother, here. My father, thank you. My grandmother, and here. She tries to hand him a $5 bill. My father, what's that? My grandmother, just take it. My father, no, for what? My grandmother, for the chicken you bought. My father, I don't want it. My grandmother, just... She stuffs the $5 into the bag. My father, I really don't want it. He takes it out of the bag. My mother comes over and snatches the $5 out of his hand. She crumples it into a ball and throws it onto the table. My mother, Mom, I don't want it. My grandmother, oh, for God's sake. My mother, looking in the bag, what the hell did you put in here? My grandmother, nothing. My mother takes the bag and rummages through it, inspecting various items. My mother, I don't want any zucchini. I just bought some. My grandmother, well, these are good ones. My mother, I bought good ones. My mother removes the zucchini. My grandmother, just take them. My mother, I don't want them. My mother slams the zucchini on the table. My grandmother, ugh, you are so obstinate. My grandmother discreetly picks up the crumpled $5 bill from the table and straightens it. My grandmother, where's your son? Me, from the living room. In here. My grandmother, where are you? I appear. Me, right here. My grandmother, sotto voce, take this. She hands me the $5 bill. Me, no, nonna, I, my grandmother, take it. My mother, Mom? My grandmother, well, let him keep it if you don't want it. Me, I'll keep it. My father gestures to me to give him the money. I do. He places it on the table next to my grandfather, who gives a slight shrug. My mother, pulling a hunk of cheese from the bag. What's this doing in here? My grandmother, what? My mother, this is the cheese I just brought you. My grandmother, you take it. My mother, why would I take it? I gave it to you. My grandmother, yeah, but you like it. My mother, so do you. That's why I bought it for you. My grandmother, I got enough cheese. My mother opens the refrigerator and literally throws the cheese in and slams the door. My mother, unbelievable. Okay, kids, we're going. My grandmother, I don't know why you just don't take the money. My mother, because I don't want the money. I swear to God, I'm never bringing anything to you again. My grandmother, good, I don't need anything. My mother, kids, us, from the other room. We're here. My father, come say goodbye. My sisters and I enter and say goodbye to our grandparents. As we do, my grandmother hands us each a $1 bill. Actually, she shoves it down our shirt fronts. Us. No, nonna, no, no, no. My grandmother, be quiet and take the money or none of you are coming back here again. We look to our father, who just nods his head and slowly blinks his eyes, which means it's okay to take the money. Us. Thank you, nonna. My grandmother, you're welcome. Goodbye. We kiss her in turn, but she doesn't actually kiss back. She offers up a cheek and then bats our lips away with it. My father hugs my grandfather and kisses my grandmother on the cheek. My mother kisses my grandfather. My mother then kisses my grandmother, meaning their cheeks collide. My mother, okay, thanks, Mom. My grandmother, for what? My mother, I'll talk to you this week. My grandmother, if I'm still alive. My grandfather rolls his eyes. My father smiles. My father, Jesus. We all shout goodbye to one another a few more times as we depart. On our way out, I see my grandmother return to the kitchen, and my grandfather walk to an upholstered rocking chair, take an Italian newspaper from underneath the cushion, sit down, and begin to read. The house is silent. The Tropiano home not only reaped the benefits of their expertly nurtured garden, but was so near the Hudson River that my grandparents were able to cull its edible riches as well. As a boy, I loved going to the Hudson with them, tying pieces of raw chicken to the bottom of crab nets and lowering them off the end of an abandoned steamboat dock into its murky waters. It's important to note that I've just written that the crabs came from the Hudson River. Some of you may know that, like most major waterways in our purple mountained majesty, it is extremely polluted, or at least it was at the time. Organizations like Riverkeeper have made a significant difference in rectifying this. A General Electric plant upriver released 1.3 million pounds of PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, which are used as a coolant in electrical apparatus and, as it turns out, highly toxic, between 1947 and 1977 into what was once known as the Lordly Hudson. Compounding this ecological indignity, Indian Point Nuclear Plant, situated one short mile from my grandparents' home, literally sucked millions and millions of gallons of water from the Hudson to cool its reactors, killing marine life and leaking toxic effluvium into the groundwater that eventually found its way back into the river itself. Yet unaware of, or just choosing to ignore all this, my family ate whatever the river had to offer, and as far as I know, none of them ever got cancer or even as much as a stomachache from doing so. One can only chalk this up to the fact that the Italian immune system is staggeringly strong. The Calabrese are known in Italy as teste dure. Translated literally, it means hard heads, and points to an innate stubbornness. However, given the longevity of my family members, it seems that their bodies may be even more stubborn than their minds. At any rate, after we had spent a few languid hours catching these atomic crabs, they were boiled and dumped unceremoniously onto a table covered in newspaper beneath a pergola wrapped in grapevines in my grandparents' backyard. They were served with corn on the cob, boiled potatoes, tomato salad, and my grandmother's homemade bread. Obviously, there was wine made by my grandfather, and cold beer, usually Schaefer or Black Label, those inexpensive but thirst-quenching ubiquitous brews of the 1960s and 70s. Even though in England the variety of crabs is wonderful, for me, the cream of the crustaceous crop is the American East Coast blue crab, sweet, delicate, and just enough flesh to make it worth one's while to keep hammering away at them for hours on end. If you have ever boiled and eaten a crab yourself, you know that they are a fair amount of work for the small amount of meat they offer. You will also know the gustatory reward is well worth it. Yes, we loved this reward, but, perhaps even more, we loved the conversation the laborious process engendered, as well as the excuse it gave us to stay a tavolo even longer than usual. As for the sides, the potatoes were boiled, salted, and drizzled with olive oil. The tomato salad was prepared as follows. Tomato salad. Serves four. 8 small ripe tomatoes, quartered or halved, depending upon their size. 1 garlic clove, halved. A glug of extra virgin olive oil. A small handful of basil leaves, torn. A splash of red wine vinegar, optional. Coarse salt. Place the cut tomatoes in a bowl with the garlic, olive oil, basil, and vinegar if using. Toss. Salt a few minutes before serving. Adding it too soon will draw the water out of the tomatoes and dilute the dish. The corn on the cob was boiled for about 6 minutes, placed on a large platter, and brought steaming hot to the table. Greedy hands then grabbed hot ears. But the buttering of the corn, well, it wasn't just put knife into butter, put butter on corn with knife. No. No. Good God. No. A piece of homemade bread was buttered, and then used to slather the salted ear of corn, thus, in true Italian fashion, creating 2 dishes out of one, the ear of corn being the first dish, and the homemade bread, now saturated with the melted butter, salt, and sweetness from the buttered kernels, being the second. This may have been the single most delicious part of an already delicious meal. An act so simple, it's almost stupid, but no one I know does it, except my family. And as far as I know, they are not simple or stupid. Well, maybe one or two. I can only suggest that the next time you eat corn on the cob, try the above, and I think you'll taste what I mean. Although people often associate corn with the Midwest, New York State has some of the best sweet corn on earth. Come August, grocery stores and farm stands are overflowing with a variety of corn that I believe is called Silver Queen, whose kernels are small and white. When the meal and the inevitable game of boche that followed were over, it was time for us to leave. As we made our way back home and my sisters and I dozed off in the back seat, our car carried the faint aromas of butter and crab as additional and welcome passengers.